and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, congressional Democrats announced that they will aggressively pursue an investigation into obstruction of justice and a wide range of other misconduct and charges against President Trump as the Mueller probe appears to be wrapping up, leaving many of the most fervent Russiagate proponents disappointed. Next, Venezuelan opposition leader and self-declared President Juan Guaido has returned to Venezuela following a trip to meet with the right-wing leaders of Brazil, Colombia, and Ecuador in defiance of a court-ordered travel ban. Then we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, and we discuss the results of the Oakland teacher strike. And then Representative Ilhan Omar has been targeted for more criticism by both her Democratic Party colleagues and a racist display set up at the West Virginia Capitol building. And finally, we discuss the latest in the Syrian war. But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. At least 23 people were killed by tornadoes that ripped across Alabama and small parts of Georgia and Florida on Sunday. People had just 20 minutes of warning before the storms came through with winds between 136 and 165 miles per hour, destroying houses, businesses, and uprooting trees. The death toll is expected to rise as rescuers search the remains. Major protests took place over the weekend in Algeria ahead of that country's election. Protesters voiced their opposition to plans by current President Abdelaziz Bouteflika, who's in poor health and rarely seen in public, to run for another term in office. The governing National Liberation Front has been in power since 1962, having led the country's hard-fought struggle for independence from France. Former Attorney General Eric Holder announced today that he will not be running for president in 2020. Holder was rumored to be a top choice of Barack Obama loyalists in the Democratic Party and was among the Obama administration's longest-serving cabinet members. Holder instead pledged to campaign for whomever the Democrats nominate. Purdue Pharma, the creator of OxyContin, is exploring bankruptcy filings due to the approximately 2,000 different lawsuits filed against them for their involvement and contribution to the country's opioid crisis. Purdue Pharma is owned by the Sackler family, one of the country's richest families. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Capitol Hill. Congressional Democrats announced that they will aggressively pursue an investigation into obstruction of justice and a wide range of other misconduct charges against President Trump as the Mueller probe appears to be wrapping up, leaving many of the most fervent Russiagate proponents disappointed. Meanwhile, Senator Rand Paul, a Kentucky Republican, announced over the weekend that he would vote against President Trump's declaration of a national emergency related to the border. This means a measure rejecting the declaration now has enough votes to pass the Senate, despite Trump's veto threat. And there's a new development. House Judiciary Committee Chairman Representative Jerry Nadler announced that his committee had sent out a flurry of letters requesting information from 81 people to kick off a wide-ranging investigation into the president. The committee's investigation is seen by many as a replacement for the Mueller probe. Nadler asserted that his committee will look into not only alleged obstruction of justice, but also the business operations of the Trump Organization, hush money payments during the 2016 campaign, and other abuses of office. Recipients of letters from the committee have been given 2 weeks to respond. We're joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net and has written on this topic in a recent article called Be Careful What You're Asking For, Wasting Time with Manafort, Cohen, and Russiagate. Welcome back, Jim.
Thanks for having me.
Jim, you've been a prolific writer on these issues. There's a piece in Time magazine entitled Why the Mueller Report Might Disappoint Almost Everybody. Tell us why that is likely the case, and tell us also why we should care about this House investigation.
Well, the Mueller Report and the House investigation, of course, are two different things. Yep. The Mueller Report was supposedly mandated to find links between the Trump campaign and Russia, which was promoted for 2 years as collusion with Russia. And now the guy who wrote this Time magazine article, Renato Mariotti, who was a former federal prosecutor, now a CNN legal analyst, has a fantastic tweet about this, about his article. He says, Mueller's report will almost certainly disappoint you, and it's not his fault. It's your fault for buying into Trump's false narrative that it is Mueller's job to prove collusion. So what they're trying, what he's trying to do
wait
is
wait a
say,
second, my head spun around twice there.
Yeah, I know. What he's trying to do is to say in this tweet is saying, you were a fool to think this had anything to do. It's your fault for thinking this, that you, the reader, that we've been telling for 2 years is collusion. It was your fault for thinking this has something to do with collusion. Mueller can't prove collusion. That's a nearly impossible bar for any prosecutor to clear. So it's just they've switched this guy, at least, and most people I think are on the Democratic side, they're going to switch the thing and say, oh, well, he can't prove collusion. But, you know, that was never really the point.
That was never the point of the Mueller probe, was to prove Russia collusion.
We should never have thought he was going to do that.
John, can you pass me that copy of Alice in Wonderland?
Seriously.
I want to just,
seriously.
It feels like reality just got tipped upside down. I mean, it's amazing.
This tweet has been excoriated on media. So in the Time magazine article, Mariotti actually says at one point, you know, this wasn't Mueller didn't have a criminal investigation. He had a counter intelligence investigation. So we never should have thought this was a criminal investigation to begin with. It's really very strange what they're trying to do.
Well, I just wonder if Mike Flynn will feel better about his indictment and guilty plea, since apparently it's not a criminal investigation.
But what's interesting is that the other branch of it now is Adam Schiff, who is saying the opposite. He's saying, oh, we already have proof of collusion. That's what he said on Meet the Press, or I think it was yesterday, or Face the Nation.
And did he say, I was traveling back from Vietnam. We covered the summit over there. What was the proof that Adam Schiff has?
The proof of collusion is, and he goes to the fact that he says, well, I think there is direct evidence in the emails from Russians through their intermediary offering dirt on Hillary Clinton as part of what is described in writing as the Russian government effort to help Donald Trump. So that was his response to the question that he was posed, do you have direct evidence of collusion with Russia? So he's going back to the famous report from 2017 of the Intelligence Committee saying Russia gave hacked these emails, which was which report actually said.
And they said that there was a high degree of confidence, et cetera, et cetera. This was by Adam Schiff. This is a generic explanation about evidence, but evidence can't be generic. Evidence has to be specific. It has to be focused. It has to be, you know, something that you can show exact culpability, right? I mean, you can't just say emails from Russians.
But they haven't even, it is not a fact that's been proven that Russia hacked the emails. And in that report that they rely on, it says judgments are not intended to imply that we have proof that shows something to be a fact. That's part of the report. They're saying this was a judgment on our part that shouldn't be taken as a fact. But in fact, everybody from Rachel Maddow to Adam Schiff has taken this as a fact.
Yes.
This report proved that Russia hacked the emails. Now, most people don't think, I won't say most people, but most people who've looked into this carefully don't think Russia hacked them. They think it was a leak. But anyway, so on the one hand, you have people like this Renato Mariotti character saying, oh, don't worry that he didn't prove collusion. That wasn't, you shouldn't have thought Mueller was going to be, that was what was Mueller trying to do. And secondly, you have Adam Schiff going, oh, we already proved collusion. So one way or another, they're going forward with this, because even if they don't do collusion, they're going to go for Trump on other things, which he has some real risk for, which are other kinds of law breaking and
like what though? But because Schiff is talking about obstruction of justice related to the firing of Comey, or the meeting at Trump Tower where Manafort and Jared Kushner and Donald Trump Jr. met with the Russian lawyer. She was here to lobby against the Magnitsky Act. They said their friend Rob Goldstone told Donald Trump Jr. she had dirt on Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump Jr. emailed back, we love it. That kind of stuff. I mean, is that what the obstruction of justice is going to be? Again, there is no actual evidence of collusion, but is that obstructing justice?
Oh, well, I think, yeah, Schiff did mention that. And I think they're not going to get anywhere with that legally with those elements as obstruction of justice. They're not going to be able to charge him with a crime of obstruction of justice for those things. What I think he does have liability for is the campaign finance violation with paying off the
Stormy Daniels.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you a question about this House investigation. Other than for the purpose of embarrassing the administration, why even have a hearing like this or an investigation like this if it's not bipartisan and you don't have the authority to file criminal charges?
Well, I think, you know, as I said in my article, I think this is a trap that the Democrats have gotten themselves into now. They control the House. They've ginned up all this excitement about this, and they got to do their base expects them to do something, and they want to impeach Trump. They're not going to be able to impeach Trump. Where are they going to go with this? They can't bring criminal charges, as you say. The Southern District of New York may go forward with investigations, but that's going to take a while, and unlikely they're going to ever indict a sitting president for that campaign finance law violations. And what are the Democrats going to do? They can't push forward an impeachment. There's no way to go with this. They know that an impeachment either leads to defeat, which is terrible, or to success, which is going to give them Pence and is going to pee off, anger many, many people who are see this as a politically motivated investigation.
I mean, the Republicans were going after Bill Clinton all those years, right, for Whitewater and this, that. Finally, they were able to impeach him on something else, lying about the fact that he was having sex with Monica Lewinsky in the Oval Office. He was impeached, but then afterwards, his approval rating was 70%. It didn't really impact his supporters at all. In fact, even though Monica Lewinsky and the affair with Monica Lewinsky was real, when Hillary Clinton said that he was just the victim of a vast right-wing conspiracy, Clinton supporters believe that because the investigations against Clinton seemed to be part of a vast right-wing conspiracy, even though they were able to get him on something else. So I don't see how it changes the political equation.
It is the mirror image of what they did, and Trump supporters are going to see that. The Democrats aren't really after impeaching Trump here. They're after stringing along their progressive voters. But in the process, they are angering everybody else who wants to. I read a great article in Reuters about this. People who had voted for Obama twice and voted for Trump, and they said, what is this? We don't want to hear about Russia. We want to hear about medical bills, and we want to hear about jobs.
Jim, in our last 45 seconds, I just want to mention to you, we were just talking to Bill Ayers about this as well. You're right. I mean, all this focus on Russiagate when there is no actual evidence of collusion. Bernie Sanders is out getting massive crowds again when he's saying free education in college, get rid of student debt, Medicare for all. And under the pressure from Bernie Sanders, the same Democratic Party elites and their media are condemning the Democratic Party now for going too left.
Yeah.
This whole thing seems to me to be like a recipe for disaster because people actually aren't going to go and vote because of this stuff. I mean, maybe some liberals will. I don't know. 30 seconds left.
Yeah, they're going. This is the way almost to guarantee a second Trump the victory, because they're going to alienate so many people who they have given nothing to and they have no program for. And this Russiagate thing is not a political program. It's never going to be.
Well, the latest polls say that if the election were held today, Trump would win Florida, Pennsylvania, and Ohio all over again. We'll leave it there. We were joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh. Jim is the editor of thepolemicist.net and has written on this topic in a recent article entitled "Be Careful What You Ask For, Wasting Time with Manafort, Cohen, and Russiagate." You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Venezuelan opposition leader and self-declared President Juan Guaido has returned to the country following a trip to meet with the right-wing leaders of Colombia, Brazil, and Ecuador. That was carried out in defiance of a court-ordered travel ban. The Trump administration warned the government of President Nicolas Maduro today that Guaido's arrest, were he to be arrested, would be deemed a hostile provocation. We're joined from Washington by Dan Cohen. He's a journalist and a documentary filmmaker, most recently of the film Killing Gaza. Welcome back, Dan.
Good to be with you guys.
Dan, there has to be confusion in Venezuela right now. What's happening on the ground?
Well, Juan Guaido just arrived to this rally in Caracas. He said he would be returning about an hour ago, and it wasn't even clear. It was only, you know, he only arrived about 30 minutes ago. Guaido was under a travel ban since 10 days. He left the country 10 days ago to, you know, take part in delivery of the so-called humanitarian aid, which totally failed. And then he was traveling around the region, meeting with presidents of all the right-wing allies in the region, Colombia, Ecuador, Paraguay, Brazil. And so now he's back in the country despite violating this travel ban. When he was entering, when he passed through immigration at the airport, he, on one hand, was saying, "We enter as free citizens." He was saying this on Twitter. And on the other hand, he was denouncing Maduro as a dictator, which, I mean, if he was really a dictator, you know, I think you'd see a harsh reaction to what Guaido is doing, which is essentially conspiring with a foreign power to overthrow the government. I mean, if we saw Nancy Pelosi, you know, trying to reach out to Russia or China to overthrow the Trump administration, you know, I think she'd be sitting in a jail cell. But Juan Guaido is a free man. He's, you know, prancing around Caracas right now and addressing a crowd of supporters.
Dan Cohen, I know a lot of people and a growing number of people in the United States are outraged over the Trump, Bolton, Pence coup d'etat efforts. They can see through it. I know on March 16th in front of the White House, people will be coming from all over the country under the demands, no coup, no sanctions, no to the war, any new war against Venezuela. And of course, you can see that there was a growing opposition inside of Venezuela to any idea that the U.S. is legitimate in intervening and perhaps militarily intervening to topple a government that the U.S. doesn't like and hasn't liked ever since it took office, even before Maduro. I'm talking about the Bolivarian process. We see that there's this kind of battle shaping up. It's a global battle between those who believe in sovereignty and independence and who believe in peace. At the same time, while the Maduro government clearly would be within its rights to arrest Juan Guaido for doing just as you depicted it, trying to foment a foreign takeover of this sovereign government of Venezuela, they're obviously not doing it, I would think, because they're worried that anything they do against Juan Guaido will be a triggering event for precisely just that, in intervention. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, that's exactly it. Vice President Mike Pence tweeted this morning that if anything happens to Juan Guaido, even threats against Guaido, then there will be some kind of swift action from the United States. I mean, we've seen that from John Bolton. We saw it. The German parliament was saying that yesterday. So I think basically Guaido is kind of like the bait, just, you know, flopping around in the water while in the Trump administration or the fishermen, just hoping Maduro will take a bite. But so far he hasn't. And I think, you know, the Venezuelans are basically playing, you know, that's their strategy, is to kind of ignore Guaido. He doesn't really have any much constituency inside the country. His real constituency is, you know, the right-wing governments around Latin America and then here in Washington, D.C. And so he can't, I don't think he can do a whole lot of damage by himself. And if Maduro basically just lets him, you know, ride around on a motorcycle and have these rallies, then he's not able to really do much. The U.S. needs the pretext of some kind of violence against Guaido, foreign intervention. There's always the possibility of some kind of false flag. And so that's something that, you know, we need to be very wary of. So, you know, if something indeed were to happen to Guaido, then it's, you know, very likely that it would automatically be blamed in Western media on Maduro, and the Trump administration would, you know, launch into this operation to pin it all on the government before the facts could get out if this were to happen. So for now, you know, it seems to be calm, but, you know, it could just go any which way at any moment.
Dan, CNN made a very big deal over the weekend over what they called massive defections of soldiers, Venezuelan soldiers across the border into Colombia, they counted something like 568 defections. Is that true? And if it is true, what effect is it having on morale? What effect might it have on the Maduro government?
Well, I don't know that there's, you know, any definitive figure about how many soldiers have actually defected. I mean, certainly there are some. When I was in Colombia a few days ago, I actually witnessed it. I witnessed a couple defecting myself. I was able to speak with a couple in Bogota when Mike Pence was meeting with the Lima Group and Guaido in the capital of Colombia. So that was last Monday. You know, even if it's a few hundred, it's really not that many. I think the Venezuelan military, there's, you know, about 110,000. So even if it's 500, considering the immense pressure that Venezuela is currently under, it's rather small. But I think the media coverage is hyping up these defections as if a military coup is imminent just any moment. You know, the military's with the people and they're all against Maduro and the coup is going to happen. When I was in Colombia, I saw this narrative being promoted so hard, even more propagandistic than CNN, you know, in English, where we have here in the U.S., CNN in Spanish. I mean, it was nonstop showing these defectors and, you know, saying that the coup is going to happen any moment. And barring an intervention, that's the only strategy that the U.S. and its, you know, and Guaido have, is to have a military coup from within. But I think that explains why there's such a the propaganda machine is going into overdrive in order to, you know, convince the world that a coup is imminent.
Yeah. So what next? We seem to be caught between a rock and a hard place here. You've got Nicolas Maduro on the one hand, the democratically elected president of Nicaragua, this coup that the United States apparently sponsored to install Juan Guaido hasn't worked out the way I think they intended. So what next?
Well, you know, I think it's really at a stalemate, as you described. I mean, so far, the Venezuelan military is still loyal to Maduro. The ministries are all still controlled by, you know, the actual existing government. You know, and the opposition is still fragmented inside Venezuela. The Venezuelan government is looking to its allies, you know, in Russia, in China, and basically looking for other ways to sell its oil, as the U.S. has put it under massive sanctions. And has been for years, especially since 2015, but with the sanctioning of PDVSA, the national oil industry, where 90% of the country's revenue comes from, Venezuela is going to really struggle to sell its oil. And so I think that's its strategy, is to basically just look to other partners for economic and diplomatic and political support. But certainly I think it's going to take a huge hit to the economy. And the Trump administration is insisting that there's no going back. So Venezuela is really in a tough position, but the U.S., you know, keeps saying all options are on the table. But so far, the possibility of military intervention has basically been rejected. The Lima Group, which is, you know, a splinter group from the Organization of American States, which is very right-wing itself,
yep,
it even rejected military intervention. So, you know, the U.S. says all options are on the table, but it's very much alone at that table.
Indeed it is. We were joined from Washington by Dan Cohen. Dan's a journalist and a documentary filmmaker, most recently of the film Killing Gaza. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? Bill focuses on the teacher strike in Oakland today. Bill joins us from Chicago. He's an activist, educator, and the co-author of the book You Can't Fire the Bad Ones and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers Unions, and Public Education. You can check out his work at www.billayers.org. Welcome back.
Good to hear your voices. How are you?
It's a pleasure, Bill.
I think talking to Bill is a measure of good luck, because every time we talk to him, the teachers have won another battle in another place.
Every time.
Well, this is something we've referenced a lot, and I understand you talked to my brother last week who lives in Oakland. But, you know, the thing about what we're witnessing is a giant, important, mega struggle for the heart and soul of democracy, which in my mind is public education. And so what we're seeing is a series of labor struggles, but each one performed as a labor struggle is also part of a social movement. And I think we have to keep that in mind. The question is, are we going to have public education? Is it going to be accessible to all? Is it going to be equitable and fair? And is it going to provide kids with a decent education? That's what we should keep our eyes focused on. And it's wonderful that in Oakland, they rallied the community. They had every famous Oaklander backing them, from Steph Curry of the Golden State Warriors to Boots Riley of Sorry to Bother You. I mean, it was a massive outpouring of community people and celebrities saying, look, the teachers are right. And I think that's critical.
Bill, tell us why this strike ended so quickly. When we were talking about it last week with your brother Rick, there were such major differences between the two sides. It looked like this thing was going to go on for some time. And even administrators in the State Department of Education said there's no way that the teachers are going to get what they want. And then in the end, the teachers got what they want, and the strike only lasted a week. Why was that?
Well, I'm not sure I have the internal explanation, but I think what we're witnessing, what you saw there is a classic kind of opening negotiating position. So the school board, you know, said we're broke, and this is a classic of how they negotiate. We don't have any money. We'd love to do the right thing, but we can't possibly. And then, of course, it turns out there's tons of money floating around, and it's a question of what are your commitments? What are your priorities? I've told you guys this, but in Chicago, after Mayor Rahm Emanuel closed 50 schools, he proposed a $95 million police academy. It wasn't that there wasn't money. It's that there wasn't money for what he wanted. That's very much what happened in Oakland. And the other thing that's critical, and we have to keep this in the front of our minds, is that what they did in Oakland, what the teachers were able to do, was to mobilize parents and community folks to say, look, we want public education in this city. We want our kids to have access to a decent, forward-looking education. We don't want to spend money on everything but education. And I think that's why it came to a head very, very quickly, because the handwriting was on the wall. The community was not going to support the beating down of teachers yet again. Now, look, we're witnessing again in Virginia. We're witnessing again in Kentucky, more stirring, more struggle. And I think we're going to see this for a long, long time, because the attack on public education is so vast and the fight back is really just beginning.
You know, Bill Ayers, you live in Chicago. I want to just turn away a little bit from the Oakland strike to the Bernie Sanders rallies mm-hmm. that took place in Chicago and then in Brooklyn. When you think back about the last, say, 8 years since the Occupy movement started in September 2011, the slogan, "We are the 99%, became popular. It became part of the public consciousness. Very quickly, that movement spread. Literally hundreds of Occupy encampments were set up. Eventually, 7,000 people were arrested in these peaceful protests. There was a coordinated assault by cities and by city police departments and the federal government. It ended. But then it seemed to me to inaugurate a sort of new level of activism around economic issues, in particular, connecting economic issues to the fundamental issues of justice, not simply sort of personal selfishness. And then you had the Sanders right. campaign in 2016, and that was unexpected, but in a way, sort of an electoral version of the Occupy movement, which wasn't electoral at all. And now we have the teachers' movement. I feel like they're all sort of living off of each other
or connected
or building blocks. What do you think about all that?
Well, I think there's no question that you're right. And this is the way social movements develop. They don't develop, you know, in somebody's head or in somebody's office or at a meeting in the community. They develop from what's going on the street, what's going on, you know, among communities. And so what we're witnessing is something that's quite symbiotic. And I think, well, you know, Sanders in Chicago yesterday, after being in Brooklyn, was really extraordinary because Sanders, you know, ran a campaign in 2016, popularized this idea, not for the first time, incidentally. I always say to myself, if we can't articulate what we mean to masses of people when we talk about socialism, then shame on us. We have to be able to say, this is what it means concretely. What, you know, during the 2008 campaign, they did some polls after Obama was elected, and among young people, socialism had a higher rating than republicanism. Why was that? Well, partly because the opposition kept saying, Obama's a socialist, Obama's a socialist. Some kids went online and looked up socialism, probably Googled it, and socialism, you know, from each according to their ability, to each according to their needs. Wow, that sounds Christian, you know? I mean, that's not some wild-eyed, crazy idea. That's a smart idea. And if we can't articulate that well to folks, it's really on us. So I think what we've witnessed is Occupy, certainly. Black Lives Matter, hugely important. Undocumented and unafraid. The unprecedented women's upsurge. These things feed on each other, just like they have in every other epic where social movements are building. For Sanders to articulate that was huge. I think what we're now witnessing is everyone in the Democratic primary trying to bend in the direction of Medicare for All is what they call it, but let's call it universal health care. Let's call it public education. I don't know if you saw in today's paper, but this is another classic. So in today's newspaper, there was a thing about Hampshire College being on the ropes financially. And why is that? Well, because of the diminishment of liberal arts education, of an education of the mind, and also because the finances of higher education are so out of control. And so to say, free higher education, wow, that's a very, not only appealing, but completely within the realm of the possible. If you get rid of the $1 trillion military budget, the incarceration state, and all the rest of the lunacy that we've had for the last few decades. So I think that this is an exciting moment for all of us.
That's the voice of Bill Ayers. I was looking at the New York Times today. They ran a story. It's just like the stories that have been running almost every day in the Washington Post and the other mainstream corporate-owned media, which is sounding this alarm like Democrats worried that the party is going too far to the left. Like, it's a drumbeat. It's a drumbeat. And the idea that too left means healthcare for people or too left means free education after high school, I mean— in many, many countries, including advanced industrialized capitalist countries, these are not even right-left issues.
No, they're not. If I could interject something here, too, there was a poll that was released just this morning by the Associated Press saying that millennials have different views on socialism and capitalism compared to their parents and compared even to Generation Xers. The poll found that something like 60% have a positive view of capitalism, but 54% have a positive view of socialism.
And, exactly.
And the people who were on the panel this morning were panicking at the notion that people like socialism.
Yeah, the sky's falling, Bill. Go ahead. We have 90 seconds left. Go ahead.
Well, I'm agreeing with you, and I'm saying watch for it, because what we're going to see is from the New York Times, from the Washington Post, from the New Yorker, from NPR, from MSNBC, we're going to see a huge pushback, and the pushback is going to be sounding the alarm. We can't win the elections if we go too far to the left. And yet, on every social issue and every economic issue, and I've said this really my whole life, but I feel it so strongly today, that on these issues, issue by issue, we are not some marginal fringe on the far left. We are in the mainstream, and we have to claim that territory. We have to say, you know, universal health care is a mainstream issue. Controlling guns in the hands of lunatics is a mainstream issue. In fact, well, I could go through the whole litany, but the point is that we should neither paint ourselves into a corner and say our ideas are so precious and abstract and difficult that no one could possibly understand them, nor should we buy the idea that somehow we're wobbling way outside and that we have to hide in a bunker what we really believe. Speak loudly, speak clearly, which is what your show is all about, and say it plain, and I think we will find ourselves absolutely organizing a majority movement for real fundamental social and political change.
That was the voice of Bill Ayers, who joined us from Chicago. Bill is an activist, educator, and the co-author of many books, and the author of many books, including You Can't Fire the Bad Ones and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers Unions, and Public Education. Check out his work at www.billayers.org. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Representative Ilhan Omar, a Minnesota Democrat who is Muslim, rejected criticism from some of her colleagues after she criticized the influence of pro-Israel lobbying group AIPAC. Representative Jerry Nadler, the Democratic chairman of the House Oversight Committee, called Omar's comments, quote, a vile anti-Semitic slur, unquote. Meanwhile, a blatantly Islamophobic display in the West Virginia Capitol building that linked Representative Omar to the 9/11 attacks is causing outrage. We're joined from Chicago by Ali Abunima, the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada and the author of the book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. Welcome back, Ali.
Thank you so much.
Ali, things have changed in the Democratic Party, even just in the last 4 or 5 years, in that it's practically a crime now to criticize Israel in any way. It's also unacceptable now within the Democratic Party to criticize AIPAC. So where do Democrats who support an independent foreign policy, support for the Palestinian people, go when the leaders of the Democratic Party jump all over you and call you anti-Semitic if you express any concern over the closeness of the U.S. relationship with Israel?
Yeah, I think let's start by noting that this round of attacks on Ilhan Omar is the second round of completely outrageous and unjustified smears against her, claiming that she's anti-Semitic for raising perfectly legitimate and urgent issues related to the outsized influence of the Israel lobby, particularly AIPAC. And of course, as a member of Congress, Ilhan Omar, like the 534 other members, will be feeling directly the constant pressure from AIPAC. So she's raising legitimate issues. But who's she getting attacked by? You said it, the Democratic Party leadership. And I think we have to see the attacks on Ilhan Omar in context. You know, these sorts of attacks weren't necessary previously because nobody dared speak up. You know,
yeah,
when everyone stayed silent, you didn't need to create this sort of atmosphere of terror where if you open your mouth, you're going to be labeled an anti-Semite because everyone towed the line. So we have to see this as a sign of change, a sign of weakness on the part of the Democratic leadership. But on the other hand, these terror tactics of terrorizing people into silence by defaming and smearing them are nonetheless, effective to a certain extent. So, you know, we have to make sure, guard against any backsliding where they manage to reestablish a taboo around Israel.
Yeah. You know, I think Ali is saying something extremely important. Because of the already enforced political tyranny against criticism of the state of Israel, meaning there's a conflation. If you criticize Israel, you're criticizing all Jews or Judaism. That's been the rule. And up until now, there's been no voice or voices in Congress. There's been a growing chorus of voices from the ground, from the grassroots, including many, many Jewish Americans who have been raising the same criticisms that Representative Omar is raising, the same criticisms. They've been on the grassroots. But if you did so in the hallowed halls of Congress, you would be condemned. So nobody did. But now she is. And this is, they're sending a message. Look, don't you dare try to speak up or speak out, even in the mildest, softest way, because you will be condemned.
And that's the word, condemned. You know, these comments from Nadler and from Engel and from other members of Congress have been so sharp and so serious and heavy, demanding apologies, condemning her. They're worried.
Yeah, and the other thing, Ali, as you well know, I mean, most people don't get their news from news articles. They get their news from news headlines. And so when you have the vile anti-Semitic slur as the standout sort of headline-ish, you know, comments from the Democratic Party leadership, people think, oh, there must be, well, there's got to be some fire here with all this smoke. Anyway, go ahead.
No, that's exactly right. That's how it works. It's all about smears and innuendo and creating an impression. And what makes it worse is, you know, the pressure is so great that people like Ilhan Omar feel compelled to apologize, even when there's nothing to apologize for. And that's what Ilhan Omar has done under this intense avalanche of pressure. And so then people say, oh, she apologized, so she must have done something wrong. She didn't. The apology was extorted and pressured out of her. And I think another really important point to make here is, you know, you don't just focus on the Democratic Party. This is much bigger. This is actually a transatlantic campaign. If you look across the Atlantic, the same thing has been going on for years in the UK, targeting the Labour Party led by Jeremy Corbyn. And now in France as well, where President Macron made a speech a couple of weeks ago promising, you know, declaring that anti-Zionism, you know, opposing Israel's racist state ideology that excludes Palestinians solely because they're not Jewish, you know, that opposing this Zionist ideology, which, by the way, is opposed by many Jews, including religious Jews, who see it as a heresy.
Yes.
But according to Macron, this is now anti-Semitism, and there are moves afoot in France to actually outlaw anti-Zionist speech. France, of course, has no First Amendment and no tradition of protecting free speech, despite all of the, you know, Je suis Charlie marches that were held. France has very draconian restrictions on speech, and these are now being deployed to silence people who say it's racist for Israel not to allow Palestinian refugees to return to their homes solely because they're not Jews. That's a fact, that Israel doesn't allow Palestinians to come home solely and exclusively because they're not Jewish. But if you state that fact in France, you could find yourself in front of a judge now.
Right. If you're someone who is born to a Jewish mother in the United States and you've never been to Palestine, you've never been to Palestine at all. Like my daughter, for instance, who's born to a Jewish mother, but she has the right to return to Palestine. And the Palestinian people who have lived there forever, whose homes were seized, they don't have the right to return. And if you raise the right of return, that's considered to be sort of a code word for a genocide against the Jewish inhabitants of the state of Israel.
Yeah. But that ideology, that policy that says your daughter who is born in the U.S. to a Jewish mother who has no, you know, has never been to Palestine, has no relatives there, you know, that ideology that says she can go to Palestine and live in a settlement in the West Bank, but a Palestinian born in Palestine, expelled, can't come back home. That's Zionism. That ideology is called Zionism. And if that's your belief, defend your political belief. But if you oppose that Zionist belief, that shouldn't be a crime.
That's right. And don't tell me what I can and can't believe.
Yeah, but that's what they're trying to do. Is outlaw opposition to racism that says Palestinians can't come back to their country just because they're not Jews. Why are they trying to outlaw it? Because it's an indefensible position in the 21st century. It's an utterly indefensible racist position. Therefore, the only way is to kind of build a fence around it and create this confusion where people who oppose Zionism on principle are deliberately confused with or accused of being haters of Jews. Now, that's obviously an outrageous conflation because anti-Zionism is anti-racism, and anti-Semitism, if you're following me, is racism. So myself as an anti-Zionist, I, of course, staunchly oppose anti-Semitism and any other kind of racism. I always stand with Jewish people against racism, against anything that targets them for being Jews. And at the same time, and completely consistent with that, I oppose Zionism, because Zionism is a racist ideology that says Palestinians should be kicked off their land or not allowed to return to their land solely because they're not Jews, and that land should be given to other people from around the world solely because they are Jews. So there's no inconsistency.
That's the voice of Ali Abu Nima. Ali, real quick, we have 1 minute left, but we wanted to make sure to ask you, we're looking at Al Jazeera. The United States has officially shuttered its consulate in Jerusalem, downgrading the status of its main diplomatic mission in Palestine by folding it into the U.S. embassy to Israel. Just give us a quick update on this, please.
Yeah, the U.S. consulate in East Jerusalem operated independently for something like 175 years and was sort of the de facto U.S. embassy to the Palestinians. And so the closing of it is part of the consolidation by the settlers who are in charge of U.S. policy now, people like David Friedman and Jason Greenblatt and Mike Pompeo, to kind of implement the Israeli settler agenda of recognizing Jerusalem as part of Israel, annexing East Jerusalem into Israel. And many people are lamenting it because it provided sort of an independent U.S. presence in occupied East Jerusalem. But the other way to see it is that it really strips away the pretense that the U.S. is anything other than, you know, a total partisan of Israel. So in their essence, it's a more honest policy to remove the consulate and to consolidate the entire U.S. diplomatic presence under Ambassador David Friedman, who, as we've discussed before, spent years raising millions of dollars to help build Jewish-only settlements in the West Bank on land stolen from Palestinians.
That was the voice of Ali Abu Nima, who joined us from Chicago. He is the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada, and he's the author of the book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Hundreds of people, including ISIS fighters, fled their last foothold in eastern Syria this morning after U.S.-backed Kurdish fighters had to slow their own advance because ISIS was using civilians as human shields. Even so, a spokesman for Kurdish forces said the battle to take Baghouz from ISIS would be over quickly. We're joined from the San Francisco Bay Area by Rick Sterling. He's an investigative journalist and member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. Welcome back, Rick.
Hi, guys.
Rick, so this is apparently the last stand for ISIS, or is it really the last stand?
Well, that's a good question. Just a few days ago, it was reported that the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces were releasing 283 suspected ISIS fighters. And then also in the last week, it was reported that a deal was worked out where ISIS fighters who had been captured were basically bargained their release, and they turned over a massive amount of gold that they had stolen from Iraq. So, you know, it goes on. The U.S. is double dealing with ISIS. Some days it's secretly assisting it, and other days it's attacking it.
So what happens now that Baghouz is either free of an ISIS presence or is going to be free? Are these ISIS people just going to go back to their home countries? Are they going to be turned over to Kurdish forces? What happens next?
Well, it's unclear. The area, you know, we're talking about is close or almost adjacent to the Iraqi border.
Yes.
So it's a little bit unclear what's going to happen there. As I was saying, that there's just in the last week, 10 days, these other reports have happened where ISIS or suspected ISIS fighters were suspected or confirmed ISIS fighters were released. And then, of course, months ago, the BBC of all publications or all media had a breakthrough story, The Dirty Secret from Raqqa. People can look it up, where they documented that hundreds of ISIS fighters from Raqqa were were allowed to depart with U.S. coalition knowledge.
Rick, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW, just came out with a report. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this the final report on the alleged chemical weapons incident that occurred in the Damascus suburb known as Douma last April. The final report was released last Friday. I'm working on an article on it. Some of the highlights, the standout items from the report, 100 plus pages, are number one, there was no sarin or nerve agent detected, which is in contradiction to the immediate U.S. reports in the mainstream media, the Washington Post and everyone else was headlining that a nerve agent was found there. And some listeners will recall that that incident happened on April 7, and just a few days later, the U.S. was bombing. The U.S. with the U.K. and France were bombing Syrian territory before the investigation had occurred, of course. Now, this final report of the investigation, it's inconclusive. They say that they have detected chlorine in some of the areas. They did not. For unknown reasons, they did not exhume any of the bodies of the 43 people who were video recorded as having been killed. So that's one significant thing. Why didn't they make all efforts to find the bodies and do an autopsy on the bodies, which would have confirmed how they had died or would have pointed to? Another thing that's significant is that at that time, it took the OPCW inspectors 11 plus days for them to get from Damascus to Douma, which Douma is a suburb of Damascus. And the Russians were saying it was unacceptable, the long delay. The Syrians were complaining about the delays. But in the West, the delay in the OPCW investigators going to the scene of the crime was blamed on Syria incorrectly. So that's one thing that's not spelled out in the report.
Do we know why there was a delay?
The delay, well, it's a United Nations body that's responsible for security. It's a United Nations, they call it Safety and Security, UNDMSS, are the initials of this body, which is responsible for the security. And they claimed Syria and Russia at the time were saying they could guarantee the safety. The UN body was saying they couldn't guarantee it. When they sent a reconnaissance team out there, they did come under light arms attack, and there was a grenade apparently, and there were even some casualties, which is curious because the area was under the Syrian and Russian control. So it's unclear. That really deserves a lot more investigation and scrutiny to know the details of that. But there are conflicting reports about who was responsible for the delay. That safety and security organization within the UN is run by an Australian. And of course, the OPCW itself, you know, has to prove its objectivity and neutrality, especially since the director general comes from a NATO country. In any event, the report is out. It's inconclusive. It doesn't assert it. It didn't have the authorization to say who was responsible for this. It kind of subtly points the finger at Syria, but it is unclear. And there's all of these big missing questions, such as is it possible that a 80-liter gas cylinder with chlorine landing on the third floor of an apartment building and leaking down into the room, is it possible that the dispersion of that gas could instantly kill or nearly instantly kill dozens of people one and two stories below? I think that's that's very questionable. They don't go into that. And the fact that they didn't exhume the bodies and do an autopsy, I think, is a significant failing.
We have 1 minute left. Rick, tell us what happens next. This report has been released formally. It's been done jointly with the United Nations. Now what?
Well, the report, as I said, they did not have the authorization at the time of the incident last April. OPCW did not have the authority to determine who was responsible. Last June, in a highly controversial and a highly debated move, OPCW was given the authority to determine responsibility or culpability. So that may happen on this event. The OPCW Executive Committee is meeting on March 12th through 15th. It's possible there'll be some information about that at that time. But right now, I think people are going through the final report and scrutinizing it, and we'll see whether the OPCW is going to make the next move and try to assign responsibility. It's there's nowhere near the evidence that they right now in that report. They don't have anything approaching the evidence to definitively blame the Syrian government.
That was the voice of Rick Sterling, who joined us from the San Francisco Bay Area. Rick's an investigative journalist and member of the Syria Solidarity Movement. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.
Ah.